Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I just learned right along with you a couple of minutes ago that power is out across downtown Seattle. There was an equipment failure at a substation, as Paige told us, and even Seattle City Light doesn't have power. That'll make it harder for them to fix the problem. We will let you know when we get an update here on KUOW. In a moment, we're going to talk about the homeless encampment known as the Jungle. We're going to talk with the man who used to look at it as his job to keep people out of there, and he'll talk about how it went down when he was doing the job in the early 2000s and what he thinks of the way the Jungle is being handled right now. Hope you can stay tuned. Well, this month marks the 36th anniversary of the Mount St. Helens eruption, which prompted this question from a KUOW listener.
I'm Russ Keldorf from Seattle, and I'm wondering what can happen to Seattle and surrounding areas when Mount Rainier erupts.
Russ asked this question as part of our storytelling project, Local Wonder, and as he suggests, Mount Rainier is an active volcano. Geologists say it's just a matter of time before it erupts. So what will happen when that day comes? We sent KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols to Mount Rainier to find out.
Carolyn Dreger is a geologist. She was on Mount St. Helens studying it the day before it erupted in 1980. When it did erupt, it killed one of her colleagues, along with 56 other people. That's when she realized how little we really know about volcanoes. She has spent her life trying to correct that.
Yeah, Mount St. Helens was a master teacher. It trained people from around the world, and it was really the event that galvanized the geologists in the U.S. who were concerned with volcanic eruptions.
So what'll happen when Mount Rainier erupts? To find that out, Dreger takes me to a snowfield on Mount Rainier. She points to the spot where the eruption might start, in a crater near the peak, just over that ridge there. That's where the last big eruption happened, about 1,000 years ago. A new eruption would start with an ash cloud that punches into the sky.
What's it sound like?
Boom, boom, boom. You know, and then a sustained roar.
The ash cloud disrupts air traffic and gums up motors, but something bigger happens next. Lava spills out of the crater at the top of the mountain. Mount St. Helens might have put out a lot of ash, but Mount Rainier is all about the lava. Some lava flows out. Some comes out in blasts, carrying rocks with it.
You can envision that there would be blocks, you know, half the size of the visitor center here at Paradise, or the size of Volkswagens, and fine gray material being blasted into the atmosphere and then falling back on the snow surface.
And is that stuff hot too? It just melts the ice?
Yes, it's very hot and it will melt the snow and ice it falls on.
The hot mess tumbles over cliffs.
When the lava flows encounter those very steep slopes, they break apart and make avalanches of hot rock and gas that is hurtling down mountain, maybe 100 miles per hour or so.
The lava stops flowing near the boundaries of the national park, but the water it melts creates a much bigger hazard, a flash flood that looks like concrete and chews up everything in its path. It pulls down trees. Giant boulders bounce on its surface, cracking as they collide with each other. It's called a lahar.
I imagine that might sound like a rocket launching or something.
Yeah, maybe so, a rocket launching or maybe a train barreling down tracks in a place where no railroad tracks exist.
We follow the path of a historic lahar down the slope of Mount Rainier to a river bottom far below.
Right around here, we'll start looking for a trail.
This is where the National Lahar dropped most of its boulders and trees around 2,200 years ago.
I hope this knocks your socks off, but for a geologist, it's really great stuff.
A river has cut through the plain, revealing a cross-section of the lahar deposits.
So on our left, we're seeing this wall of rocks, big boulders, you know, the size of basketballs, and it looks like something that a human being has constructed.
Yeah, it's almost like some ancient Roman, like, city wall.
It looks like a big ruin.
The town of Ording is built on lahar deposits. That tells us a lahar could surge through the area again someday. Scientists say Ording will probably have plenty of warning before an eruption. But just in case, there's a backup plan. When the siren goes off, people in Ording have roughly 40 minutes before the Lahar hits.
I would encourage people to just be immediately moving towards higher ground, any way to get off of the valley floor in a hustle.
That's Scott Hines. He's with the Pierce County Department of Emergency Management. We're walking around a neighborhood full of cul-de-sacs, kids, and basketball hoops.
Now, these houses we're walking past here, they're two-story houses. Could people just climb up to the second story?
No, that would not be high enough to get out.
A Lahar at Mount St. Helens proved that.
There's a famous picture of a house coming down the Toutle River and smashing into a bridge and demolishing the house. You know, it's why we want people to pre-plan and to have an escape route and to know how they're going to evacuate, because chaos during the evacuation is going to lead to more fatalities.
No one knows how big a Lahar would be or how far it would travel, but Hines wants to show me how far it could come. He takes me to Fireman's Park, high on a bluff above the port of Tacoma.
So you can see the cranes over there. You can see the rail yard. You can see 167 and I-5, a steady stream of semis that are coming in and out of port.
Everything we see, he told me, could be covered in cement-like mud by a Lahar. Routes connecting Tacoma to Seattle could be buried. We'd have to dig them out. Tacoma could face shortages of food and supplies. Most of its hydroelectric dams and water sources also lie in Lahar zones. Then there are long-term problems. Decades of flooding and erosion as rivers cut new courses through fresh Lahar deposits. Sediment settling in the ports of Tacoma and Seattle could cost billions of dollars to dredge. But Mount Rainier, the mountain that could cause so much devastation, also defines us as a region. It's deeply embedded in the culture here. It appears on our license plates and on our quarters.
Everybody has all these positive vibes from the volcano, and sometimes I feel like I'm gossiping about the prom queen when I tell people that I'm here to talk to them about the hazards from the volcano, and not everybody wants to hear that.
But Carolyn Dreger is a geologist, and she sees Mount Rainier and its eruptions as part of a much longer story. In the mountains around us, she sees the remnants of volcanoes that have come and gone. The Cowlitz chimneys to the east, they're made of cooled magma, the cores of volcanoes exposed by centuries of erosion.
You know, this is a relatively impermanent piece on our landscape. Our lifetimes are just too short to appreciate how much change can happen.
Mount Rainier could change dramatically in our lifetime. Statistics show there's a volcanic eruption in the Cascades 2 to 3 times every century. At the base of Mount Rainier, I'm Joshua McNichols for KUOW.
Makes it relatively nice to live in the moment. Enjoy the day. That story was inspired by a question from our listener, Russ Keldorf, and you can hear more of our stories from our Local Wonder series at our website, KUOW.org. Thank you, Russ. While you're visiting us there, leave your local wonder about the Puget Sound region. What do you want to know? If your question is picked, then a KUOW reporter will run it down.
KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. It's a quarter past noon, partly sunny and 62 degrees in Seattle.
I'm Norman Olney. On the next To the Point, political vitriol like this is hard to take back.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot.
But leading Republicans have changed their tune when it comes to Donald Trump, and some of his fiercest critics are quietly encouraging donors to get in line. Others warn you can't repackage a demagogue just for the general election. Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Fred Hutch, where women scientists are committed to making life-saving discoveries and shaping modern medicine. Seattle's nonprofit research center celebrates these women scientists and the next generation they inspire. More information at fredhutch.org. Cures start here.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with an update on that power outage across downtown Seattle. We told you that there was an equipment failure at a substation, and Seattle City Light now says that they think they'll get everybody back up and running, power back on, in about 25 minutes. So Hammering Man will be able to get back at the job. We'll keep you posted. Thank you for tuning in today. At City Hall this morning, Mayor Ed Murray again called for swift action on the jungle, the homeless encampment under I-5. The city and the state have started implementing their plan to clear the place out, and not for the first time either. Back in the early 2000s, it was Jordan Royer's job to handle the jungle for Mayor Greg Nickels. Royer's approach was to keep the jungle as clean as possible and push everyone who camped there out twice a year.
My approach was to get everybody on board, manage expectations, and make sure that everybody understood what the strategy was, what we were trying to accomplish at the end of the day. And I'd be very straight with people saying, we're not going to solve this problem completely, but we're going to manage it in such a way that we are not going to have the crime issues that were really what was bothering the neighborhood and obviously was threatening people's health and lives. And so what we tried to do is we went in there and we talked to people and we said, you know, we're going to clear out the jungle and you have 24 hours to leave. We told them, we went in there with Real Change, with Seattle PI, with Seattle Times reporters, with service providers to let people know where they could go. And then we said, you have to leave. And then we're going to come in and we're going to clean it up, clip back on the vegetation on the areas around the jungle so that there was natural surveillance from the neighborhood inside the jungle. We actually built a gravel road through the jungle so that police could drive through there and kind of keep tabs on the situation, monitor it. And then we committed to the neighborhood that we were going to go in there and clean out the jungle two times a year.
How well would you say your approach worked?
Well, it worked for as long as Greg Nickels was in office. I think when Mike McGinn came into office, they didn't use that approach, and they, to my knowledge, didn't do any cleanouts and didn't do any kind of maintenance of the situation. And unfortunately, what you get is what you have now. It's completely out of control. You've got fires, assaults, rapes, drugs, all kinds of things that are happening in there. What's interesting now that's different than when I worked on it, though, I was shocked to see permanent structures in that area. That is kind of shocking to me that that was allowed to happen. And once that happens and it starts to be like, you know, the place where everybody knows that they can go and, you know, get certain things, you know, most likely heroin and other drugs, it just becomes a place that you no longer have control over, and it's almost like a government unto itself. And I think if, you know, you let it continue to fester in one place like that, you're just going to get more and more problems and more people are going to die. And I just don't think that's acceptable.
When you would go into the jungle, this homeless encampment, you know, to kick people out, how did they react to you and what they'd say?
Well, what's interesting is, you know, we went in and talked to people, and people kind of understood, and they said, okay, well, you know, that's what the rules are. And that's why I say when you manage expectations and people understand what the rules are and that the rules are going to be enforced, people will adjust.
I ask because, as you know, we've heard from people who live in the jungle now who say the city is trying to kick us out of our home.
Well, sure, that's, you know, it's illegal to camp in there. So I don't really understand, you know, why, if you want to, some people would like to make it, you know, bring in porta potties and, you know, all of this infrastructure and things like that so people can live in the jungle, which I think is really a bad approach. I think what you're going to do is facilitate more people getting sick, more people dying, more rapes, more of all of that sort of activity in there. And I, again, don't think that's acceptable. You're always going to get people who say, you know, don't do anything. But frankly, part of the problem with our city right now is that people don't think that the rules apply to anybody.
We know that people don't always use the shelters that are there for various reasons. They don't work for them. Given that, isn't shutting down the jungle twice a year just chasing people around the city?
Well, what you're trying to do is trying to, and this is a law enforcement tactic on all kinds of different things. When you have the goal here is not to allow, again, as I've said before, an area to be so so used and so comfortable for people to come and do all sorts of different things. And frankly, there's a lot of crime going on in that area. What you want to do is keep it moving a little bit. I know that that sounds like a kind of a Band-Aid approach, because it frankly is. You're always trying to get more people into housing. Frankly, I would support an approach that New York State has where you have a constitutional right to shelter. And what that allows you to do is the advocates can sue if there's not enough shelter available for people. And it allows jurisdictions to say, look, we know you're homeless, but you can't sleep on the street, you can't sleep in this area, but we do have shelter available for you. Now, if they don't take that shelter, you've got to, you know, continue to work with them, do outreach, and all these other things that I think the mayor is trying to do right now. But, you know, some people, frankly, are, you know, not ready to go into shelter, and you've got to keep working with them, but you cannot allow large encampments in an area that is so isolated, like the jungle, to take place because people are going to die. And I guarantee you, if the city decided not to do anything, more people would die in there.
We've heard that the city would like to shut the jungle down for good. Can that happen?
Well, I don't think you can do. I don't think you can do that either. I wrote a piece for Crosscut about this. That the if this is managing expectations. You have to manage it and control it. But to think that you're going to keep people from camping in there permanently or that it's never going to be a problem again. Pretty Pollyannish, I think. And from what I've heard is the city does not plan on fencing it off. I heard that last night from the mayor's person, Scott Lindsay, who's in charge of this. So I don't think that's on the table, and I agree with the mayor that that would be a bad idea to fence it off. And I would urge the city council also not to kind of throw a monkey wrench and make this a long, drawn-out process. But, you know, you just kind of manage it, and you try to keep it from getting out of control. You try to keep people as safe as possible. But are you going to stop people from going in there and doing things? You're probably not going to be able to.
Jordan Royer had the job in the early 2000s of handling the homeless encampment known as the Jungle for Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels back then. The city is working to clear the place out. Royer, as you heard, saying the jungle can never be permanently emptied. It can just be managed. Seattle City Light says it hopes to have electricity back on in downtown Seattle in about 15 minutes. Twitter is telling us that Seattleites are being polite and orderly. Welcome to KUOW's Record. I'm glad you've tuned in. I'm Bill Radke. Disgusting, fat, angry woman. There's rape everywhere. Shouldn't leave your phone at home, sweetie. No one would want to rape that fat, disgusting mess. Those are just a few of the things people have said online to Seattle writer Lindy West. The people who make awful, shocking online comments are commonly called trolls. They make threats and say terrible things, usually while hiding behind a username that keeps them anonymous. And the conventional wisdom is, ignore those trolls. Don't respond and don't engage. Instead, Lindy West has made a career out of doing the opposite, by calling out trolls who target women online. She wrote about that in her book, Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Lindy told Jeannie Yandel about a recent run-in with a commenter on Instagram.
Last week, there was some guy who had been sending me just ridiculous insults on Instagram. And
like what? What was he saying to
you?
Oh,
it was just like, oh, you're a fat loser and your husband's a loser and he married a whale and you could eat a whole whale. And you're like, okay. And I clicked on his profile and he was clearly like an adult man. Like, he wasn't a 14-year-old boy. He was like a 35-year-old man. And I just wrote back, like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? And do your friends and family know that you harass women online for fun like a child? What is wrong with you, man? Like, what's wrong with your life? Why don't you go do something with your life? It's so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing. Can you imagine? And he was like, and he actually answered my question. He was like, no, they do not know that I do this. Please do not tell my girlfriend. She would be really mad at me. And so then I was like, oh, good idea. I just clicked on his account and there's all these pictures with his girlfriend who seems very nice. So I just sent her a message and I was like, hey, is this guy your boyfriend? Because he has been harassing me all week and if it were my husband, I would want to know. You know, if my husband was doing this, I would want to know. So just FYI, here's a screenshot of the messages he's been sending me. You don't need to write back. I wish you well. Bye. And then I told him, like, I had said back to him in the comments, like, oh, well, maybe I'll send her some screen grabs and she can help you. Because he had been like, I'm trying to get help for my trolling problem. So I was like, maybe your girlfriend, maybe I'll send her some screen grabs and then she can help you. And then he just started groveling and begging and was like, please do not contact my girlfriend. I love my girlfriend very much. And like sent me a picture of like a dinner from Benihana that he bought her. And I was like, I don't care, man. But it was just so pathetic and hilarious. And so anyway, and she never wrote back. My suspicion is maybe he like went into her phone and deleted it before she could read it. I don't know.
You don't just make a point of spending time outing and talking to people who come up with really uninteresting insults. You have also called people out who have said, frankly, awful, scary things. People who have threatened violence. Why do you think that that's an important thing to do as well?
Well, when I get really violent, scary comments, and you can tell which ones are threatening and which ones are just trying to get a rise out of you, because some people are really viscerally scary. And those ones I don't really touch. I report those and block them. And I haven't gotten to the point where I was afraid enough to contact the police. But that's what I would do if it was a really specific, scary threat. You know, like, I'm going to come to your reading on this date and murder everyone, whatever. That's something where it's not like I would sass back on Twitter. I would quietly screen cap and report that to the police. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a level of violent, but not so specific, you know, just still kind of unsettling threats that you get. And I don't know, with those, I don't usually respond to people directly, but I do sometimes post them because I think that a lot of people don't know the extent of this problem and what especially female writers and journalists are putting up with all day, every day, and how, I mean, cumulatively, it's really scary and it really makes you feel unsafe and targeted. So I don't know. I think one big reason why I engage with trolls on the internet is to make the problem visible to other people who aren't living with my Twitter feed. You know, that is really important to me. And also, there are a lot of especially younger women who are just thinking about entering journalism or writing or blogging who are nervous and who write to me and say, I want to do this, but I'm scared of trolls and I'm scared of being harassed. And so I feel like if I can talk back and fight back in a public way and embolden some of those women to maybe not be so scared and give them a script for dealing with their own trolls and, you know, be a model for how you can still do this job and not be chased away. That's really important to me, too.
In the book, though, you also talk about, I guess, what it's cost you. You talked about having to build up a kind of armor and that armor can be heavy. Do you think it's been worth the cost?
I think so.
How come?
I said that so fast, and now I'm not sure if that's true. No, I mean, it's definitely made me stronger. I mean, I used to be painfully shy, and the worst thing I could imagine was someone detecting my deepest insecurity and making fun of me for it. And now that happens to me every day, and it really... it's powerful that I've learned how to deal with that. It makes life a lot less scary. And I really feel like, as painful as it's been, I've learned a lot from being constantly harassed on the internet because it makes you face your biggest anxiety, which has always been people being mean to me, people not liking me. You know, everyone wants to be liked. I really want people to like me. I mean, good people. I don't care if Donald Trump likes me or whatever. But I mean, I wouldn't have a career if I cared what everyone thought about me, because a lot of what I do is criticize bad people. But, you know, I was always afraid of people yelling at me and people making fun of me. And it happens every day now. And I feel fine. And that's really empowering.
I'm remembering something you wrote in the book. You talked about, well, you talked about loving fantasy as a kid. You talked about kind of escaping into fantasy stories. And you compared fighting trolls online to fighting dragons a little bit. Maybe you've become this lady knight.
Yes.
And you fight.
Finally.
But you're not fighting one dragon. You're fighting an infinite number of dragons, it seems like. So I don't know. When do you get to stop? When do you get to hand the sword to somebody else?
Soon, probably. I'm bored of it. I am tired. I don't have to do it forever. There are all kinds of really smart, radical young people who are taking over these internet spaces, and people who know a lot more about web development than I do. You know, I don't know how to fix internet trolling. I know how to critique culture, which I think is maybe the key component. You know, the problem isn't that Twitter exists, it's that misogyny exists. So that's the most effective way I can spend my time is writing this sort of feminist cultural critique. And I hope that I contributed in some way to people feeling like they can fight and they know how to.
Lindy West is the author of the book Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. She's going to be talking about that book tonight at a sold-out event at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. You may be able to catch her tomorrow, though. She's also going to be at Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Now, what can poetry teach us about our city? That is the question Seattle's first civic poet is asking. Claudia Castro Luna is using her position as the city's civic poet to hold a series of workshops around Seattle, workshops that invite people to think and write about their neighborhood. Claudia Castro Luna told KUOW's Elizabeth Austin why she wanted to focus on neighborhoods.
We live in place. All of us do. All of us love and shop and dream in a particular place. And given that the city's changing so much, I thought this would be this idea of going to different neighborhoods and spending time in those neighborhoods and inviting folks to voice their opinions through poems was a perfect way to capture the mood of the city. And focusing on neighborhoods and place, because we all have stories about the place we live, what we like about it, what we wish were different, memories that we have. So that's the idea.
So you're holding a series of workshops at Seattle Public Libraries, and the workshops are focusing on neighborhoods. Who are these workshops for? Who do you hope will come into the library to do one of these workshops with you?
Well, the workshops are really open to anyone. I started in the Southwest Library because that is my local library, and I thought, you know, this is a good place to start. And the first workshop, I had kids, 10-year-olds, and I had a couple who had grown up in West Seattle and ended up going to the same elementary school as the children who were there, which was wonderful. And they were in their mid-80s. So, and then there were folks my age there. And so it really is open to anyone. I'm designing experiences that are really open to anyone who could read and write.
What did you learn about how people see their neighborhood from that first workshop?
Well, it was interesting because the old folks were so touched by the fact that these two young boys were going to the same school. And they talked about what was Seattle looked like when they were growing up. You know, in California, the junction has changed. The school hasn't changed. So, for instance, the old man asked about the third floor. Is it where the fourth and fifth graders are? And of course, it's the same. So there was this wonderful moment of connection. And I felt, oh, here's our neighborhood getting smaller just by this conversation that we're having here. And of course, for the kids, they were startled to know that these folks had gone to the same school. So my hope is that we could connect to each other. And I think that's essentially what happened. And everyone wrote poems and we shared poems, and especially the children were very enthusiastic.
Claudia, did you bring us any examples from any of the workshops you've taught so far?
Yes, I did. I taught a workshop at the South Park Library, And it was a really wonderful experience. I was invited to do a bilingual workshop, and the turnout was fantastic. There were a lot of young children. I knew it was going to be young children, a children's program, essentially. And the wonderful thing was, I read poems to them. We talked about poems, and I thought, will they really write? I mean, there were a lot of people there, you know, and babies crawling. But everyone, when I asked them to write, they sat down and they actually wrote. Even moms wrote. And dads wrote with their kids. It was really amazing. And for them, I thought writing about the city was harder. So I invited them to write about animals, because kids, I felt, have a direct relationship to animals. So some kids drew. The kids that could not yet write actually drew pictures, which was fantastic. And then Kadra wrote this poem, which if I could read it, it would be wonderful, because it combined both the spirit of this work that I'm trying to do with what we were talking about that evening. So she wrote, "Busy road, busy street, lights shining in every corning, buzzing, coming from the people feeling the streets." So she used this buzzing because we had read a poem about bees. And I just love the way she then extrapolated that to life on the streets. It was just fantastic the way that all came together in this little poem. And I love the way she rhymed every corner to corning, because, you know, the previous word ended in ing. So I love the rhyme and just the coming together of all these thoughts we had discussed.
And it ends up being a kid's view of her neighborhood.
Yes.
What do you think about when you think about neighborhoods?
What do I think about? I think cities are multiple spaces, right? Lots of things happen at the same time in a city. You could be having a quiet moment at a local park and somebody else is having, you know, a crazy experience on the street downtown. So there's these multiplicities that happen. And neighborhoods, I think, are mini microcosms of the city in some respects. And in a way, they reflect back to us the place we live. And when they don't reflect back, and this is what I'm encouraging people to do, is to ask why. You know, how is it that it doesn't reflect back the place you would want it to be or you would wish it to be? Because I think there's a moment of awareness there. Most of us don't necessarily think about the street we live in and who picks up the trash and how are we connected through these systems. But if you take a moment to think about that, there's a moment of awareness about place. And once you have that awareness, I'm always the teacher. You know, I taught for a long time, so I'm always the teacher. And I always think, what can you then do? It's an invitation to be open to a civic discourse, I think. I mean, that's my hope around this discussion of neighborhoods.
And is there something about poetry that helps further that conversation?
Yeah, I think so, because poetry doesn't go to policy. Poetry goes to feelings and memories and the immediate experience that one is having. And I think that sheds a lot of light about, it's very truthful. It's close to the skin, you know? So I'm hoping that that there's that moment of awareness in the writer. And I'm hoping that by them sharing those poems with the rest of us, we could get a sense of how is our city working? How is it reflecting back to us?
Claudia Castro Luna, Seattle's first civic poet, there talking to KUOW's Elizabeth Austin about her series of workshops that explore neighborhood. Her next poetry workshop is going to be this Friday morning at 11 o'clock at the Southwest branch of Seattle Public Library. The theme is The Neighborhood We Dream Of. If you would like to hear Claudia Castro Luna reading some of her poetry about neighborhoods or just find out more about her workshops, then come see us at our website, KUOW.org. This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State votes for Donald Trump. In yesterday's state primary, Trump won 76% of the votes, handily beating all the candidates on the ballot who aren't running anymore. which means Washington's delegates will vote for Trump on the first convention ballot. They are actually pledged to Ted Cruz if there's a second convention ballot. For the Democrats, Hillary Clinton won yesterday's primary, but her party will ignore those results because they already had the caucuses, which were won by Bernie Sanders. But tell that to the superdelegates. They supported Clinton even before the primary. Is this a weird way to elect our leader? Well, okay, who does it better? Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer joins us every Wednesday with news from Canada. Vaughn, would you like to trade electoral systems with us?
I think you're just trying to confuse me.
You think? I'm telling you facts.
I believe that it's possible that Cruz and Trump both won and that Sanders and Clinton both won, and yet it would appear that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Do you find our system as confusing, then, as we do here?
Yeah, and we haven't even got to the Electoral College yet.
That's right.
But, yes, the American system is different. I think it depends on how things are going in the two countries. We went through a stretch where we didn't have majority governments in our parliament. We had, in order to get legislation passed, you had to put together alliances of two or three parties, the way they do in a lot of the European countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a lot of elections. And at that point, people were going, well, you know, the Canadian system, the parliamentary system is not very reliable. It's not stable. You get a lot of extra elections. And even though those of us who cover elections find elections fun, the public looks at the price tag and goes, do we really need to hear from these people again?
Mm-hmm.
But when you go through a wild political year like you're going through in the United States at the moment, we just had an election that produced a majority government for 4 years. Canadians are kind of going, well, this American system is certainly entertaining, but I'm not sure we'd really want one like that. The truth of the matter is there are some things about the American system that everybody up here admires or ought to, and some things about the American system that we wouldn't wish on our best friends, namely you.
Well, what's one thing you admire about the American system?
I like the separation of powers, actually, and the division of powers. I like the fact that in order, I realize as people contemplate gridlock in Washington, D.C., they go, oh, gee, that's not so great. But I do like the fact that the American government needs a level of consensus and, to some degree, bipartisanship to make major changes in the country. If you think of some of the people that have made it to the presidency over the years, the thought of there being no check on their power really is kind of disturbing. So I think the system works well that way. I like the accountability of presidential appointments and judges and that sort of thing. Here in Canada, basically our prime minister is a bit like a dictator between elections, too much power. So some of the checks and balances in the American system I find admirable. I think most people look at the American Bill of Rights and the Constitution and are impressed with the fact that the system has survived this long and this well. So all those things are worth looking at. In our system, one aspect of accountability that I really like is that our prime minister has to stand up in Parliament regularly, like the British one does, and answer questions from the opposition. It's not a press conference. It's there, and you're in Parliament, and you're accountable. And for better or for worse, I think that's one of the nice features of our system.
Do you have the booing and the razzing that we hear from Great Britain?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. You haven't heard about Elbowgate. In Parliament last week, our Prime Minister is in trouble because he elbowed his way onto the floor of Parliament, grabbed some opposition member by the elbow, hauled them over, and accidentally elbowed somebody else in the chest, a woman, a member of the opposition. So he's had to apologize to Parliament for his raucous behavior. We don't usually get physical in the chamber, but...
But is there a lot of... That kind of stuff.
That's right. Yes,
I'm not sure I did that well, but that's my impression of British Parliament. Yes. Okay, so listen, I talked yesterday on the show with a couple of ex-leaders of our state Republican and Democratic parties, and they told me that your parliamentary system is inherently unstable. You mentioned a little unreliable, unstable, but I sure think of Canada as stable. So what does that mean?
What they mean by that is if no party wins a majority of seats in Parliament, and sometimes they don't, then you're either looking at the need to form a working relationship with other parties, and those agreements tend to break down fairly quickly. You can get the situation they have in Spain right now, where they've had no government at all for a few months. The economy seems to be doing well in spite of that, and they're going to have new elections. We've never gotten to that point in Canada, but we have had stretches where we've had two or three elections in a fairly short time frame until the parties sort it out. So that's the disadvantage of our system. And, you know, it comes and goes. When the voters in their wisdom elect a majority government, well, you, as I say, you get a dictator for 4 years. When they don't elect a majority, when they elect a whole bunch of parties, you can get the instability, the back and forth that you get where you get more elections in a short time frame.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, who sensibly, reliably joins us every Wednesday to talk news from Canada. Vaughn, thank you.
You're welcome, Bill, and someday you're going to have to explain to me why you have a city named Vancouver as well.
Who got there first? Which Vancouver is older?
Okay, you did. Okay, fair.
Give us that.
So why does your state have the same name as your capital?
Okay, touche, as they say in French. Thank you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle writer Melanie McFarlane told you here yesterday how she tackled her depression with some help from the drag queen RuPaul. You can hear that conversation at KUOW.org. You just search RuPaul. Or maybe you prefer the written word when it comes to working through difficult issues. Book lover Nancy Pearl and Marcy Silman have a book recommendation for you.
The title of this novel is Imagine Me Gone by a man named Adam Hazlett. This is his second novel. He also has a collection of short stories. And from the cover, which is a brilliant, brilliant cover for this book, to what the book deals with, it's just a wonderful, albeit painful, reading experience.
Imagine Me Gone makes me think of suicide. Is that what this is about?
It's about depression, and it's about depression running through a family, beginning with the father and then really coming full bore at the oldest son. And we've had those books before. I mean, that's not an unusual plot. But what the author, what Adam Hazlett brings to this is he's written a book that's told from the point of view of every member of the family, the father, the mother, and the three children. And as each person takes over the narrative for a chapter, we move forward in time. So we begin with the mother, Margaret, meeting her husband. And even though she knows that he suffers from deep depressions, decides to marry him anyway, and then moving through each of the children. The novel is centered around Michael, the oldest son, the one who is really under the grip of depression and anxiety. And I don't know that I've read another novel that explores this so well, so that you're in Michael's head.
I believe I heard an interview with Adam Hazlett a few weeks back, mm-hmm. and this is his life, very fictionalized, but this was his own experience.
Really?
And he mentioned that he also suffers from depression, although not to the extent that his older brother or his brother did, and his father.
His writing is just amazingly wonderful in here. And when I finished this book, I went back and have begun reading his first novel.
You mentioned when we started off that this is a heavy topic. So first of all, is the writing good enough to outweigh reading about something like that? And second, who would you recommend this book to?
I'm not sure that that's a negative, that it's a heavy topic, because I think there are people, and I know and love many of them, who really love heavy books, who are really interested in exploring the human condition through fiction. And I think that's what Adam Hazlett does. I think that it's so interesting that we never get a completely fleshed out picture of each of these characters, but we know them so well through their accounts of what their lives were like. I mean, many of the books about mental illness that are on the shelves are memoirs, But I think that what Adam Hazlett is doing is he has stepped back and he has allowed us to partake, really, of Michael's life and its crises.
The book is called Imagine Me Gone, and the author is Adam Hazlett. Nancy Pearl, thank you so much for bringing this book in for us.
You're very welcome.
Imagine Me Gone is doing pretty well at Seattle Public Library. The website there says all of its copies are in use, but of course you can put a hold on it. Adam Hazlett, H-A-S-L-E-T-T, is the author, and that's Nancy Pearl talking with KUOW's Marcy Silman. You will find more of Nancy's picks, of course, at our website, kuow.org. Come see us at Twitter, at KUOW. 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us today.